Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
Welcome to Recovering Gleek, a podcast for all of your complicated feelings about the TV show Glee.
Are you ready? Ooh, I know you see me standing here. Do I minisode good, my dear?
Whoa, do I minisode good?
Do I minisode good today? Ooh, ooh, ooh. I'm just another podcast girl. And you wanna see my world. So come and listen away. Yeah. If you wanna play, come and play today. Let's just get away. Welcome to Minisode 101.
Ooh.
An original joke, a joke we've never made before.
Never, and not recently, even if we have made it, because we never have.
Yeah, we certainly did not make the same joke Mm-mm. on the 101st episode of Glee New Directions. I don't know Mm-mm. what you're talking about.
Ooh.
Fresh jokes. Ooh. That, of course, was the Zoe 101 theme, Follow Me, made famous by Jamie Lynn Spears.
Of course. Do I minisode good, my dear? I really love that.
Does she?
Does she? That song is so silly.
I know. The fact that it starts out with just like, I see you looking at me. Do yeah. I look good? Let me know.
I know you see me standing here. Do I look good? So it's like, this show is about 11-year-olds. Disgusting.
Seriously? Oh my gosh. My mom used to get very upset when like the Nickelodeon and Disney Channel shows we were watching were really about like the kids dating each other.
Yeah.
And I was always like, lighten up, mom, when I was like 9 years old.
Yeah.
And now that I'm a full-fledged adult, I'm like, no, it's gross that these kids who were like 12 years old, all of the plot lines were about them dating each other.
I know. I did a little dating when I was like in my like late elementary, middle school, junior high years. And it was all a mistake. Every moment.
Yeah. It was like, my mom, I think I talked about this already. My mom, when we saw the Lizzie McGuire movie, was like, I cannot believe that movie exists. And as a kid, I was like, what? A young girl goes on a great adventure? But in my mom's eyes, it was like a 14-year-old goes to a foreign country unsupervised, meets a strange man, and runs around Rome with him.
Yeah.
Like, that's the message that movie was putting into the world.
And you know what?
It's great.
That was the dream. I was obsessed.
It's a work of art.
That movie.
That's what dreams are made of.
I don't think I've seen that movie in a long time. But, oh my God, how old is Paolo supposed to be?
I think he's 17. I think he's supposed to also be a mitre.
Okay.
It doesn't make it makes it less creepy for sure, but it doesn't make it not creepy.
Not creepy. You're right.
Yeah.
That movie's so good. You know who's so my favorite part of that movie? Ethan Kraft. Eating spaghetti.
Oh, heck yeah.
The best. Just here to have a good time in Rome. Have you seen the video of Meghan Trainor meeting the guy who played Ethan Kraft?
Mm-mm.
Oh my God, that video is so silly. You should look it up sometime, but it's sweet.
Have you seen the video of Meghan Trainor being married to Julian from Spy Kids?
It's all I see on the internet.
I'll never get over that fact. It's crazy to me.
I remember when they got married, it was crazy. Now they have like 2 kids. Crazy.
Also, his name isn't Julian because it's Junie.
Junie.
What's his name? Yeah, Junie. You guys, I haven't seen Spy Kids in a long time.
Ever. He's actually never seen Spy Kids.
I've never seen. It's something I'm very self-conscious about. I just pretend that I've seen Spy Kids. Hey everyone, my name is Ian Allred and I was a spy kid. And then I turned 18 and they kicked me out. They said, sorry, don't get to be a spy adult.
And you didn't become a spy adult?
You know something that actually, as a child, when these movies came out, really annoyed me about this movie series?
Mm.
This is me. Picture it is 2002. I am canonically 7 years old. Seeing Spy Kids 2, the Island of Lost Dreams.
According to the canon, you were 7.
According to the canon, God's canon, for what has happened on this planet, I am 7 years old at the time of the release of this movie. And I, as a seven-year-old, was angry because the fun part about the first Spy Kids is not that, like, Junie and Carmen get enlisted to be spies. It's that they find out their parents are spies and are in trouble, and so they, like, of their own volition, then take over as spies. And it felt like, to me as a six-year-old, very anti-establishment, very, like, kids taking the power, like, really exciting, we're doing it for ourselves. But then I saw Spy Kids 2, and suddenly there's a whole, like, Spy Kids spy organization? And I was like, no, the fun thing was that Carmen and Junie were rebelling against the establishment and taking things into their own hands. Not that, like, kids being a being spies was already a known thing in the world.
At first it felt rebellious, and then it, like, became the man's thing. Like, that's pretty boring.
Yeah, and now, like, their work, like, they sold out.
Yeah, they, my God, such sellouts. They sold out. You're right.
Carmen and Junie are huge sellouts, and to finish this intro, I am a mini clique.
That's so funny. I feel like I know a lot about... Hey, what's up? I'm Lena Knatzer. I feel like I know a lot about the Spy Kids because I feel like I watched the Spy Kids very recently. And not just, like, for anything, but for my own enjoyment because those movies are great. And I'm a mini clique.
Contrary to popular belief, we are not here to talk about Spy Kids. We are here to talk about The Backup Plan, Season 5, Episode 18 of Glee.
Mm-hmm.
And y'all have some thoughts about The Backup Plan, so let's get into them.
Let's hear some. All right, let's kick things off with Amanda.
It's kicked.
Consider it kicked.
Hi, Ian and Lena. I'm a longtime fan of the pod who decided to email for the 101st minisode. Ooh, almost as good as the 100th. I was a huge Glee fan when it originally aired, but the season 3 finale, having Rachel get into Niata over Kurt, made me quit the show. And the spoilers about everyone breaking up made me never go back. About a year ago, I found your friends over at Gleek of the Week podcast, and listening to random Glee songs from the seasons I missed finally made me want to see what happened after. Last month, I completed my first full watch with my roommate, who had never seen it before and who I show all your TikToks to. I really enjoyed your episode on The Backup Plan. I'm not as keen on the Rachel plot as you are, mostly because it ends with her once again getting something for no reason. But I agree it's a good idea for a story that might have worked had we had several episodes of Rachel starring in Funny Girl. However, what really gets me about this plotline is Santana stepping in for Rachel for a show. I realize that the Glee writers have no idea how Broadway actually works and just wanted to have a Santana-Rachel friendship moment, but I do not think an understudy who previously quit the production would be allowed to arrive at the theater, get into costume, and just tell the producer she's going on. Purely from a safety standpoint, Santana quit the show before it even went out of town, and presumably has only watched the full Broadway production once from the audience. As far as I've gleaned from over a decade in the Broadway fandom, understudy preparations are not just about knowing the book and score, it's making sure you know the actor's pathway through the show, on stage and off, so there are no mishaps in the crowded backstage area. Fanny is an incredibly difficult role who basically only goes off stage to change costumes for the next scene and run her next entrance, yet Santana just knows what to do. I could buy that Rachel has incredibly intense notes on the show that Santana could borrow, but the episode as presented shows none of this. It's also weird to me that nothing comes of this. I feel like if Santana really did that great of a job, she would have been offered a new understudy contract, since they need more than one. It would also have been fun to tie the Sadie's plot back into it and have the producer be more into having Santana on the album because she has 15 minutes of fame for being the random girl who played lead on Broadway for one night because Broadway obsessives love a heroic understudy situation. Alas, Glee thinks playing the lead on Broadway for one night is something you can just do as a favor for a friend and maybe not even get paid for. I realize I'm overthinking this, but as someone who worked for a theater chain during the worst waves of COVID cancellations, I've heard a lot of understudy saves the show stories, and Glee's take did not impress me. And if we had to do this, could we at least get another Naya Rivera Funny Girl cover? Sigh. Anyway, thanks for reading. This podcast is one of my favorite parts of my week. And I cannot wait for you two to tackle season 6, which I found surprisingly enjoyable after the awkward end of season 5. Hurt Locker's part 1 and part 2 secret masterpiece? Consensual forehead kisses to you both, Amanda from New Jersey. Hurt Locker's part 1 and part 2, public masterpiece.
Public. No
question.
That's
the goal of this podcast. It's not a secret. We want everyone to know.
I can't even, honestly, I love those episodes so much in my brain. I'm so nervous every day that we're going to watch it and like not feel as good.
I've rewatched them pretty recently.
Oh, you did? Okay, good.
I will say, I think that part 2 fizzles out.
Do you?
Part 2 fizzles for me. Part 1 is nonstop banger. The thing is, you have to know what you're getting into.
Sure.
And you have to know this episode is just Ian Brennan with no restraints.
Yeah.
They are throwing out the laws of the universe. They have given up on the show having any sense of realism or being grounded at all. They know that the show is going off the air in 10 episodes. So they really said, Ian, do whatever you want with this episode. And as long as you're on board with
it's amazing.
It is so fun.
I'm so excited. So I love those episodes. I seriously think about so many of the moments from those episodes just constantly. I cannot wait to watch it. Mm-hmm. But I am nervous to get there because that means we're going to be done so soon.
I know. I dread season 6. I also, as you mentioned, Amanda, season 6 is surprisingly enjoyable, but I dread season 6 because then it means that our days are numbered.
Oh my God. Dead Girls Walking.
So something I'd like to point out is you grant these writers a lot of grace, Amanda, and you say, I realize they don't understand how Broadway works. I think they do. They just don't care. Because
they don't care. And they think the general audience doesn't care.
Yes, exactly. They are like, the general audience doesn't know how this works, so we don't care about realism. Because, like, Ryan and Brad have worked in the entertainment industry a long time, but, like, I don't know if they've ever done stage. But Ian Brennan was a stage actor professionally. And then also, in the cast, they have got Lea Michele and Jenna Ushkowitz, who and Matthew Morrison and Jane Lynch, who have all been on Broadway before. Like, there's enough Broadway people in this room that they know how this works. Mm-hmm. They just do not care.
And not mention British Tony Award winner, Amber Riley.
Yeah, but that hasn't happened yet. But they do have a future British Tony Award winner, Amber Riley. But I do get that it's like, for the sake of telling a story... You don't need to be like, your understudy fell off the lip of the stage and your standby is out of town and the swing is sick, and to have the general audience be like, what were those last two things?
Yeah, I hear that.
Like, I understand it doesn't need to be fully realistic because we're just here for telling a good story and not like delving into the logistics of a Broadway theater.
Yeah, it is interesting. Like, how did she get even into the building? I feel like... in shows that I've done, I've either like had keys or someone has like let me into the building, like, and like signed me in.
I think she called the SM
because
the stage manager clearly knows that she's there when Sydney comes up and he's all worried about telling Sydney. So I think she knew that the stage manager was a huge pushover. And so she called him and was like, here's the deal. The show's not going on unless I'm in it. So let me in the building, put me in the costume I'm going on. However, I do have an interesting story, which is, Amanda, you are so correct. In professional theater, usually understudies, you know, you have to know the whole show. You have run the whole show before. You have been on stage. You have like done all the things for safety reasons before you go on. That's not always the case. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite stories ever is Donna Lynn Champlin, who listeners might know as Paula Proctor in Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Her Broadway debut was she was an understudy in James Joyce's The Dead. And she, at the time that that show was happening, was in a different show off Broadway. And they offered her the understudy track, and she was like, here's the deal. I won't be able to attend rehearsals because I have this off-Broadway show. And they said, don't worry about it. You're an understudy. You don't have to be at the rehearsals. We'll teach you the understudy track after the show has opened. And so she attended, I think, like the dress rehearsal and watched it from the audience like Santana. And then during previews or during like opening week or something, the part that she understudied was unable to go on. And she got the call and they were like, Donna, you're going on for the show tonight. And she was I've never run the show ever. And they said, well, we're not refunding these tickets, so you're going on tonight. And she, you know, crammed, like, looked at her notes, talked to the stage manager to try and learn the track as well as she could. And then she went on stage and she talks about how she talks about this on a podcast. Oh, God, what is this called? Broadway Backstory. She's on a podcast called Broadway Backstory where she tells this story. And so I'm going to butcher it. So if you want to hear the real story from the woman herself, listen to that. But she talks about how she went on stage and like knew the part as well as she could. And then beyond that, just kind of the whole cast banded together
to help her get through the show.
Yeah. Like if she was in the wrong spot, they'd be like, oh, come with me and like link arms with her and pretend that they were speaking to her and lead her to her next spot. Or if like she had a song coming up, because I don't know James Joyce is the dead, but the way that she talks about it is it's like a lot of people at a party just kind of like talking and having fun at a party. And so if she had a song coming up that she was supposed to sing and she was forgetting, they'd be like, oh, we'd love for you to sing us a song. I'll start it with you. And then they would like sing the beginning of the song with her until she remembered what song it was. It's a fascinating story.
That's interesting. Yeah.
So Santana's not the first to go on without any rehearsal and have to cover a lead role in a musical on Broadway.
I know. Sure happens. Live theater is insane.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And also, thank you so much for this message. I really appreciate it. Up next, we've got a message from Story.
Before I read Story's email, I want to say it's possible that Donald M. Champlin told that story on a story, bada bing, on a podcast called Show People. Now that I think about it. So it's either Show People or Broadway Backstory. One of those two, one that she was on is the one that she told the story on.
Obsessed.
Anyways, on to Story. Hello, LPC and Ian. To be honest, I always have and still do hate this episode. I do agree with you both that the biggest problem is just the timing of it all. We, the audience, have spent so long dreaming of Broadway with Rachel, and all of the last episode was dedicated to getting Rachel through her opening night. Then we're given emotional whiplash the very next episode because now Rachel's not satisfied and wants to leave Funny Girl. This plotline wasn't given enough time to breathe in real life or in universe, and frankly, it was too soon for a major Rachel plotline at all. Opening night was all about Rachel, which was fair and made sense because it was her starring as Fanny in Funny Girl on Broadway, but I personally could have lived without another Rachel A or B plot for two or three more episodes. Let me, for a moment, paint a word picture for how I wish this plot had gone for Rachel through seasons 4 and 5. Bear with me, I'm going to go on a journey here. First off, we're getting rid of the time fuckery that Glee did in the first place. Season 4 is going to conclude at the end of the leftover New Direction school year, like all the other seasons. We're going to scoot the timeline up for Rachel auditioning for Funny Girl just a tad, so that Rachel is officially cast as Fanny Bryce in the second to last episode of Season 4, the same episode where the Glee Club loses nationals and finds out that the Glee Club will have to be disbanded forever. Then the last episode of Season 4 can be the New Directions episode. We do the normal summertime pickup and hit the road running with Funny Girl in Season 5. Santana's cast as Rachel's understudy, drama erupts, the fight ensues. Santana and Rachel don't make up, but Santana does still decide to leave the production. And because this is my fantasy, Santana doesn't disappear off the show for large swatches of time. She and Rachel are comically avoiding each other and storming out of rooms when the other appears, etc. Rachel does not yet drop out of NIADA, but hold on to that thought. Opening night is now the mid-season finale for season 5. It's an emotional high for Rachel. She has everything she's ever wanted. She got into the school of her dreams. She's literally Fanny Bryce in Funny Girl. What more could there be? Close opening night on a The Graduate-esque moment. Maybe the timing is still sorted out, so Wemma had their baby in this episode, and Rachel's on the phone with Will, and he's like, for the first time in my life, I'm truly happy, but I'm sure you know the feeling. And we linger on a shot of Rachel alone in her dressing room with her opening night flowers already losing petals, and she says, yeah, happy. Now we enter into Rachel's decline, which will mostly happen in the background of the show. Rachel is constantly trying to shoehorn herself in on other people's drama or life events, and someone will say, "Don't you need to be getting to the theater? You have a show tonight." We bring back the Niada plot. Rachel has stopped putting any effort into her classes at all. Maybe she's struggling to keep up with 8 shows a week plus classes. Carmen Thibodeau suggests that Rachel take a hiatus from school until she's able to completely commit herself to it. But Rachel is a Broadway actress, and she is so above this school, so she immediately drops out. And now we can finally circle back around to the backup plan. Rachel has now experienced an arc where she was unsatisfied in achieving what her lifelong dream was and began to feel more and more unmoored. Sydney Green is less of a monster to make this more impactful. Maybe when Rachel asks about getting time off, he makes some joke like, "Besides, it's not like you'd be asking for time off to audition for something else. Your contract is airtight for the next 6 months." So Rachel still decides to lie about being sick. Now, when Rachel has to call in Santana to fill in for her, they are still feuding, which I think is really impactful for a lot of reasons. And this is the episode where they make up, and Santana can say something like, "You acted like a fame whore with balls the size of the Brooklyn Bridge and no regard for how your actions would affect everyone around you. It's like I'm looking in a mirror." Anyway, that's basically it for how I would restructure the entire Rachel plot of late season 4 and season 5. I feel like this is Glee's era of completely disregarding the ideas of planting and payoff. So threads are either dropped never to return or followed up on so fast the audience doesn't get to sit with them. Or sometimes even a bizarre mix of the two. And for me at least, it makes this part of Rachel's story unwatchable. I can't wait to hear you two old dogs' new thoughts next week. Forever a covering Gleek story, she, her. P.S. When you said you'll be covering Into the Woods in the next Patreon episode, I gasped out loud in my car. That is my favorite musical, and I'm so excited to hear what you have to say. Well, story, I hope you are excited because it's long.
Yeah, how long did it end up being?
I'm not done with it, but it's like 4 hours, 50 minutes around there. It's long.
4 hours and 50 minutes?
Ooh.
Ooh, I know you see me standing here. Do you want to talk about Into the Woods for 5 hours? We should like...
Are you doing nothing today?
Honestly, and here's the thing. I think if you and I was thinking about this, had to teach a class on Into the Woods, not that we know everything about Into the Woods, I think we could really like make a whole semester's worth of stuff to talk about.
We got 5 hours worth already. I know. All we gotta do is learn about classes, music so that we literally can talk about the music theory
once
stuff.
Once we learn about music, it's over for these hoes. No, seriously. For real. Get excited. I love our conversation. I'm really excited for people to listen to it.
Anyways, onto the meat of this email story. I do think, I super agree that Glee, you can tell, is in an era where they aren't planning anything. They're just flying by the seat of their pants. And for their spontaneous era. And I grant them grace for it in season 5 because I realize they are all grieving, and B, whatever plans they had to be reworked. So, like, I understand they're scrambling, they're going through
this
a hard
time.
This
is their backup plan, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. This season is their backup plan. But in season 4, you already see it happening.
Oh,
the
yeah.
way that they don't, like... I feel like season 4 does not feel like it had a plan from the beginning to the end. Season 4 very much feels like the writers trying new things and then realizing those new things aren't connecting with the fans and trying desperately to course correct halfway through. Mm-hmm. And I feel like season 4 not ending with a graduation is because they didn't know what they were doing anymore. They were like, we worked really hard on developing these newbies and then... the audience wasn't connecting with the newbies, and so now we're trying really hard to focus more on the seniors, but now they're going to leave, and we just started focusing on them, so let's just end at regionals and keep them around for like an indeterminate amount of time. And if the writers of the show had more forethought in planning season four, I think this timeline would be fantastic.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Because, yeah, it's like we spend so long with Rachel auditioning for Fanny, rehearsing for Fanny, preparing to open as Fanny, and then they finally open the show. It has been a full calendar year as a viewer watching this happen, and the writers are like, the season ends in 3 episodes, and we want to take this character in a new direction. So, a new direction. Uh-huh. So we have to undo all of this as fast as possible, and what should be a multi-episode arc then happens completely in the backup plan so that they can get Rachel going in a different direction for season 6. Yeah. And it's messy. I think opening really night messy. As the mid-season finale would be fantastic.
Yeah. And I love the idea of her just like struggling in the background for like a while. I like that. Yeah. I mean, like you said, Ian, it's hard because I feel for these writers in the sense that they're grieving and they just kind of like, you know, this is their backup plan. And like, I don't know, but there's certainly a way they could have done it. I don't know. But I love this. Yeah.
I think they bit off more than they could chew with season 4, and it continues to haunt them, which is why, spoiler alert, they end up downsizing for season 6.
Yep.
Which is also why they ended up downsizing in season 5 and said, let's just commit to New York.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think, like, season 4, they realized they were very, very ambitious and then realized, oh, we aren't equipped to handle
I mean, I can't imagine. Like, they are filming on location in New York sometimes, but then they're filming at McKinley other times, and like splitting the time between the two places, I'm sure, is like difficult, like money wise and like actor wise and like idea wise. Like, they are obviously struggling and on all fronts.
American Horror Story is really popping off right now.
Word.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about that.
So
in
Ryan's
a
like going off working on his other show all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is. Well, Story, you're such a smart person, and I really appreciate you sharing these ideas with us. I think this could have been amazing. Up next, we've got a message from Abby.
Hello. I just finished listening to your episode on the backup plan, and I had a realization that I need to share with you. When you were discussing Rachel feeling stifled and then connected it to your experiences as actors, it made me think about how I feel as a teacher, especially being so early on in my career. When you mentioned that landing a role makes you feel like you need to dedicate all of your time to that job, it really resonated with me. I also don't know any adults in corporate jobs that feel this way, but those in education and those in the arts do for sure. I'm in my second year of teaching, and I also can't help but feel stifled. In theory, I understand that I will be more fulfilled if I have things outside of my own career to do for fun, but it's so difficult to do that when I've had this goal for so long and there are so many people who depend on me. It's more work to take a day off, even when I need to, and create plans for a substitute, just like many actors feel like they can't miss a show even when understudies are available. I am one of the people who never really understood Rachel's decision to leave Funny Girl so soon. But after listening to the two of you discuss it and being able to relate to the story more, I guess I'm coming around on it. I do wish that we had seen more of Rachel experiencing the pressure and monotony of the job, as I may have made the connection much sooner. There isn't really a point to this email, but I figured I'd chime in and let you know that I appreciate the new perspective that I have after listening to your thoughts. Abby, she, her. P.S. In regards to the Klain storyline, Kurt himself fell in love with Blaine after hearing him sing one time, so I'm sure he knew what he was getting himself into by inviting Blaine to sing for June.
Abby, I love this. And I think thinking about it and from an education standpoint, oh my God, I feel like I've watched so many teachers that have been my teachers, teachers in my life, like really like struggle with the monotony of teaching and like, oh my God, how do you take a day off from teaching? Getting a substitute is so difficult. Oh my gosh.
And it's hard to go into a job that you're passionate about.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like the ideal situation in life is you love your job and it's fulfilling. But the double-edged sword of that is your whole life can become the job because it is your passion. And at the end of the day, it is a job.
Yeah.
And jobs are hard and difficult and have bad stuff about them. And you can feel like, well, if I leave this job, what was it all for? Like, yeah. I ruined everything.
Your time.
Mm-hmm. Like, I gave up on my dreams. But then even beyond that, even if, like, you don't want to leave the job, but you want to have a life outside of the job, it can feel like you're also abandoning your dream.
Yeah,
it can
absolutely.
Feel like, well, I need to keep working at this and, like, changing the world and doing what I set out to do. And it's like, no, it's okay for it to just be your job for a while or forever. Like, it's okay for it to be your job.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Acting is, like, hard in that sense because actors are just, like, so obsessed with it. And then also, like, you have to audition. But I do think it's easier to, if you're at a certain point in your career, have a life outside of acting than it is with teaching.
Yeah.
Because teaching involves so much outside of school planning.
Absolutely. I knew so many teachers who were, like, just there all night long, putting their stuff together, putting in grades, mm-hmm. putting their classes together, like, meeting with parents and students, being available at all hours to answer emails. Yeah. That job takes up your whole life.
Yeah, because I could be like, you know what? I'm not going to audition for a while. Like, I'm going to take a break from auditioning. You can't be like, I'm going to take a break from planning lessons. I'm going to take a break from grading papers. Like, you can't do that.
No.
So truly, my heart goes out to you, Abby.
Absolutely.
Teachers are the backbone of society and they get so little support. It is horrifying.
Yeah. Thank you for this message.
My advice for entrepreneurs is definitely to level up with Shopify. The platform is just never a worry. Like, I have so many worries, but the platform is never one. I feel like Shopify really thinks about how they can optimize. It just always feels very ahead of the curve. Everything is just super easy to connect and link. They really know what we need. Time and money that is saved, I can spend on other things and on growth.
Start your free trial at shopify.com.
Up next, we've got a message from London.
Hello, Lena and Ian. It's London, not Tipton.
Oh, from Toronto, I totally Canada. Thought it was gonna be.
No. Well, okay. London, Tipton's we're skipping really over this great. Email. Anyways, up next, we have an email. We only put this in because we thought it was London, Tipton.
Yeah. Freak.
Hello, Lena and Ian. It's London, yes, Tipton, yay me, from Toronto, Canada. And I wanted to fill in my thoughts on the backup plan, specifically the Kurt plotline. As a regular Kurt defender, I'm always going to be the first to sympathize with him, but this plotline sparked something very different in me. Here in Canadian theater school land, we have this thing called Next Generation Showcase, where the graduating classes of each theater school in the country can choose two pieces to film and post on a website for casting directors, agents, etc. to view, and then possibly reach out to us after the fact if they liked what we submitted. As someone who watched all of my classmates get hits in the first 2 months and me not getting anything until after I had graduated, I can really understand his thought process here. First, he chooses a song that is not at all like him. At first watch at the show, I was like, why the fuck is Kurt singing a One Direction song? It's not his range, and it doesn't at all speak to him as a performer. However, Kurt has seen his two besties from high school get record deals and Broadway shows within 2 years, and he feels that maybe this song and weird train choo-choo dance moves will make him more palatable and marketable. He wants the level of success his friends have, and he will do what it takes to achieve it quickly, rather than what is more effective for who he is as a performer. I know that some of the feedback that I got about my pieces was that they just weren't marketable for film and TV, and I spent so long wishing I did something more modern and palatable. It's also funny that Kurt is singing a song called Story of My Life when it has, in fact, nothing to do with his life. Secondly, Kurt, who in the past has told Rachel that she is making a mistake about quitting school for Funny Girl, rolls over immediately and tells Rachel to go to her audition. While he doesn't fully support the choice, Rachel kind of traps him in making him at least not try and stop her when she brings his career into it. She says, if someone came to Niata and asked you to do this TV show, tell me you would say no. This is completely unfair for Rachel to do, since they are completely at different levels in their career progression, and using that against Kurt here to get him to not stop her, because yes, he would take this audition because he doesn't have anything else, is therefore made to think it's the same for Rachel. Plus, Blaine fully lying to Kurt is gross, and I hate how awful that is to promise someone opportunities about their dream career that don't in fact exist, especially to the person they want to spend their life with. By the way, comparing the weird song Piece of My Heart to a tavern scene had me guffawing and giggling. Again, thank you for your lovely content twice a week. It always brightens my commute and makes me feel connected to a community of people who love and do theater beyond just the city I've lived in my whole life. P.S. Can't wait to hear your thoughts on Child Star. I will be emailing for Myron, my love. Sincerely, London, she, her. London, I loved this email until that last sentence.
Don't say it.
You know, I have only seen Child Star one time because I hated Myron so much, I couldn't stomach it another time. But maybe there's been plenty of episodes of Glee that I remembered hating and I ended up liking. Mm-hmm. So I'll reserve judgment.
Yeah.
But my feelings about Myron are the opposite of yours, girl.
Oh my gosh. Obsessed. I love this email, and I completely relate to, like, having those instincts and hearing feedback that you need to make yourself more marketable, and then that feeling untrue to you. You know, like, we see Kurt doing this, and maybe he's doing it to be more marketable and palatable, and it just doesn't fit on him. Like, he doesn't seem comfortable. It doesn't look like he is, like, shining in this moment. And I feel like in my life, I've definitely had moments like that where I've, like, wanted to fit into a box, and then, like, that box looks stupid on me because it's not my box, you know?
That's what I like about this plotline, is it's not... Kurt is less talented than Blaine. It's that in this scenario, Kurt wants so desperately to be marketable that we can see how hard he's trying and how unnatural he's being, that he's not being himself.
Yeah, totally.
Whereas Kurt Blaine is more being himself in the moment. And so, like, yes, everything you say about the song choice, London, but then beyond that, you can see in his face, like, how hard he is trying and how much he's trying to be like, look how fun and cool I am. And unless you're auditioning for a character who is desperate, that's not going to read.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, and I think that's a trap that people fall into all the time. Like, unfortunately, there just are people who, like, their natural thing is more mainstream and therefore they get picked up easier. But you putting on a different person's thing is not going to work. Like, you trying to, trying to emulate someone else isn't going to work, because the reason they're successful is because they are being themselves.
Yeah. It's so hard to be yourself sometimes, you know?
Truly. One of my favorite lines in all of SNL is, it's a Bachelor sketch, one of the Bachelor sketches. And the girl comes up for the one-on-one and she's like, hi, my name is Jennifer and I've never been myself even once.
I feel that. I'm obsessed. Oh, well, great. London, thank you so much for this message. We love you even if you're not London Tipton. Up next, we've got a message from Irene.
Hi there. Return of Irene, she, her. I have thoughts on the Rachel and Clayne plots. On Rachel, I totally agree that it could have been an interesting plot, but oh my gosh, it was too rushed. One of the many flaws this season is it feels like they're doing a lot of one-off / isolated episode plots rather than full season arcs. And this Rachel plot could have been very interesting if they moved opening night earlier and spent some time on it. One thing that would have helped would be if they mentioned Finn. It's always weird when, aside from occasional mentions of him, they don't really go into the character's grief. I understand that it's due to real-life factors that they don't want to use it in the show too much. But these characters had a huge loss that would affect them, especially Rachel. Broadway was her dream, but from season one, Finn also became her dream. I think that added to her fulfilling Broadway feeling so hollow because Finn wasn't there to see her. We heard her plan to make it on Broadway and then return to Finn, so her life with him would have been her what's next. But now that's gone, so Broadway is the only dream she really has. So I do get them not wanting to discuss it too much on the show because of Corey. But looking through that lens is how I've always tried to justify Rachel's choice in these episodes. Onto the clean of it all. I will show my bias, because Kurt is my favorite character, and I lost interest in Clayne after season 2, but this plot kind of bugs me. We just had a bunch of episodes where Kurt is finally earning recognition, feeling confident, etc., and it was interesting to see the dynamic shift and how Blaine would deal with it. Then they deal with it by almost immediately shifting back to Blaine as the star and Kurt has to be the side support. It really shows how all their plots are so reliant on each other, because all of Kurt's best plot lines were when he and Blaine were apart. When it was just him in New York, he was basically one of the male leads and made a whole life for himself. Now Blaine is there, and Kurt is reverted back to being the sidekick, and Blaine can take over as the star. It's especially frustrating because we've seen Kurt do great duets, Happy Days, for example, and the idea that he wouldn't perform Broadway for June is ridiculous. It would have been nice to use this as a chance for Blaine to be the support for Kurt for a change, or for them to be equals, but instead they're going back to the season 3 dynamic of Blaine being the alpha/passing gay while Kurt is ignored. I believe at this point Chris wanted to sing less, very sad, especially as it was because of the show making fun of his voice all the time, but they could have used that to let Kurt do something else, maybe return to Vogue, but they just can't have him succeed more than Blaine, especially as we'll see next episode, and it just bugs me. I can't remember where, but I heard that Chris didn't want Kurt to become a writer. Maybe too much overlap with TV versus real life, but it would have been nice to see Kurt listen to what his dad said and write the roles he never got to see growing up. I don't know, just so many things they could have done to keep Kurt's arc of gaining confidence and finding himself, but instead they reduce him to Blaine's sidekick, and aside from a bit next episode, he gets no real plot lines outside of Clayne ever again. Sorry for the ranting, and thanks for making such a great podcast, Irene. Irene, you are so correct. I do, like, when I watch this episode, find this dynamic interesting. But when you point it out, it's West Side Story again with Tony. Mm-hmm. And, like, it's an interesting dynamic. It's also a dynamic we already saw.
Yeah.
And back in Tested, as you mentioned, Irene, it was so interesting to see the inverse of that, where now Blaine, who has always been the one that has had everything handed to him, is in a world where Kurt is the alpha dog and he doesn't know where that leaves him.
Yeah.
And having them abandon that so quickly is a little disappointing. Like, yes, this plotline is interesting. We also have seen it play out. We have not seen that other plotline before. That would have been something new. And we have just thrown it away to do this June Dalloway thing.
Also, Irene, I think you're so right when you say that, you know, I mean, at least I feel Finn's, like, presence in the Rachel plot in the sense of, like, what you say, like, that was her dream after Broadway. And now that's kind of gone. And what happens now? But I also think you're so right when you say that they probably don't want to say that because it's just a little too real for them to, like, use that in this TV show. And I just completely agree with you when you say that.
Yeah, I think it's one of the situations, one of the rare situations where the viewer's headcanon should stay as, like, a viewer interpretation and not be in the show.
Yeah.
Explicitly, yeah. I think it is kind of baked into the show, but totally. Most of the times when listeners, like, have headcanons where they're like, well, I view this storyline through this lens, I'm always like, oh, I wish they would have written that into the show more clearly. But in this situation, I'm like, I kind of respect and am glad that they don't bring up the Finn stuff more.
I agree.
Because it, you know, it's a really complicated situation.
Yeah.
And it would feel kind of gross to me to, like, totally. Just really be milking it for plot fodder.
Absolutely. And I mean, like I said the other day in opening night, like, that, like, the Finn stuff, Corey Monteith, immediately evokes an emotion in every single person who knows anything mm-hmm. about this show. Like, and I think that they have to be really careful about when yeah. they talk about Finn. And also, like, for these, especially Lea Michele's health, like, as a person. Yeah. I just think it's not good. Yeah. And not to mention the entire rest of the cast who loved him and the crew as well, you know?
Yeah. So Irene, I agree. I think that that does have a big reason as to why Fanny feels hollow to Rachel.
Yeah.
But I also am glad the writers did not explicitly go into it on the show.
For sure. Irene, thanks so much for sending this. Up next, we've got a message from Bethany.
Dear Lena and Ian, my name is Bethany from Goombangierland, Australia.
International listener!
Australians, I try my best, okay? I try my best. I have been listening for about a year and a half and was very sad when I caught up because I couldn't binge listen anymore while working on large puzzles.
Puzzles! I love puzzle people.
Well, if you join our Patreon, Bethany, you can work on a puzzle for 5 hours. But it's all right. You guys can now help me wash my dishes or cook dinner once or twice a week. I'm finally writing in because I honestly love Rachel, and she is now embarking on my favorite journey of hers in the whole show. I think she is one of the most consistent, well-established characters I've ever seen, and mostly due to a through line I have noticed of hers that leads us here to this very episode. This begins way back in the first episode of season one. When we meet Rachel, we find out that she has been participating in dance and vocal classes and participating in competitions from an absurdly young age. I think the actual line was something like she won a dance contest at only a few months old. We also learn that she has two dads and her mom was a surrogate. Later, when we meet Shelby, it's clear that her vocal talents were a contributing factor, if not the key reason she was chosen as a surrogate to contribute her genetic code to Rachel. In season 2, when the club goes to Rachel's basement to party, she says her dad's built her a stage there for her to perform shows for their neighbors on. In season 3, the Hudson Hummels are treated to a dinner show performed not only by Rachel, but alongside her dad's, who clearly also have a special interest in theater. We also rarely see Rachel's dads in the show compared to, say, Kurt or Finn's parents. This is odd, given she is the main character, and her parents slash childhood are regularly alluded to. It leaves the impression that she isn't very emotionally supported by them, especially given any time they're referenced, it's in relation to the opportunities they have given her to become talented. This leaves me the impression that her dads have literally designed, prior to conception, for her to become the lady who gets to star on in a Broadway show at only 19 years old, or whatever her canonical age is at the moment. When we meet Rachel, she is desperate for love and approval, and I think this is because she hasn't felt truly loved from her dads. Her relationship to her dads is that she wants them to be proud. She wants to make their money and investments into her worthwhile. So she falls in love with Finn Hudson. I think she sees in him the kind of earnestness she was missing, a person who, if he loved her, it wouldn't be because she's talented. And that ended up being true, but it took a while for her to get there. First, she had to meet Jesse and Shelby. Jesse was her first boyfriend, the first guy she was vulnerable with in many ways, her first attempt at love, and then Shelby was her mom. She was the hope of a kind of relationship she didn't get with her dads, someone she could go to when her costume was terrible and she was afraid of being laughed at. Then, within likely a week of each other, she found out that these two hopes for genuine emotional support and relationship were dead ends. Jesse had lied, he'd pursued her to put his acting skills into practice and the whole thing was fake, and then he left her to be her competition. Then Shelby said she didn't want to be her mom and didn't want to continue a relationship with her, preferring to watch her from afar and be proud when Rachel gave good stage performances. And then Shelby continued to be her competition. This affirmed hard for Rachel that love doesn't work out for her and she has to focus instead on outshining them. She's only good for her talent. So she then threw herself into her talent to help her move on by trying to win at regionals, which failed. This is a habit of Rachel's. She pursues emotional relationships hard. Then, when they don't work out, she throws herself back into her talent hard. You can probably recall a sleepover scene between Herkert and Mercedes when she was laying plans to pursue Finn and Mercedes shot her down, reaffirming that she should instead focus on her talent. Finn was the first person to really see her and love her, and she loved that. She would have given up everything to be with him. While I don't love that storyline for most young women, for the girl who was born and raised to believe that love didn't work for her and she had to instead focus on her talent to be a person of value, this was beautiful for her. Then he made the ultimate betrayal and, like everyone else, prioritized her career and talent over their relationship without her input by sending her on that train. I think this kind of broke Rachel. Again, she dove headfirst into a career to move on. Working hard to make a name for herself at her school, she became Hot Rachel and dated then for status and arm candy as opposed to genuine connection, because love doesn't work out for her and she's finally realized it. But then she starts to reestablish hope as she recognizes that Finn did what he did to try and show her love, and as her and him start to mend the hurt that Finn caused, they begin to show fondness for each other again. And then he dies. When Finn dies, we don't really see Rachel address it very often, but her actions are loud, especially when we consider her track record. Firstly, she doesn't date anymore. This is a first for Rachel. Prior to this, Rachel always had ongoing crushes and was always pursuing someone, if not dating them. Like I said, she needed and was seeking emotional connection and approval, but now she doesn't care. The one person who genuinely loved her for her is gone, and she doesn't think she'll ever get that again. So she throws herself hard into her work. All she thinks about and cares about is Funny Girl. It's a needed distraction, and a perfect one at that, because it reestablishes what she's always known. Love doesn't work for her. She's only valued for her talent. It is no surprise that it is so soon after Funny Girl begins that she grows tired of it, because there's no distraction anymore. Nothing to work on or pursue. She's not trying to beat the competition anymore or learn the lines or impress the critiques or impress the critics. She's done it all. Now she's stuck going through the motions. Now she has the time and energy to miss Finn and appreciate everything that she's lost. But this is so fucking traumatic. She needs an out. She needs something to pursue, a new distraction, a way that she can focus on her career and talents so she can move on from the most devastating loss of her life. The loss of any potentiality of love, of not just being the person with talent, of being someone worthy of love. Of course she sabotages. Of course she tries to go on for the next thing, to become more famous, to take her talents to the next level, even if it means leaving behind the dreams of her childhood that she's established the whole show. This decision is the most in line with her character choice that she's ever made. This decision is the most in line with her character choice that she's ever made. And I love where it takes her. I love where she ends up in season 6. And, spoiler alert, I love that she hits rock bottom. Because I think that finally gives her the opportunity to heal. Anyway, this is long, but it's my biggest, most important take on the whole show. So I hope you guys appreciate it. Love listening to you guys. Bethany.
Whoa. This is an intense take that I love. I love this. Wow.
I love this emo, Bethany. I have been vocal about Rachel being my favorite character in season 1 for this whole podcast. And this just kind of opened my eyes to how the things I love about Rachel in season 1 are kind of present. Yeah. For the entire show.
Yeah.
I have always viewed Rachel as just a very funny character, because it's like everyone who was a theater kid either was her or knew her, or more likely both. You kind of were her and then also knew other people who were like her.
We had a little club. Yeah.
Yeah. But on top of that, I've always found her to be such an incredibly sad character. Mm-hmm. For these very reasons, that it's a girl who people don't like. I always go back to the scene in, I think it's the pilot. I think it's when she's on the bleachers with Will and she says, "Nobody at this school likes me." Mm-hmm. And that is always so tragic to me, that it's like, you know, she's an only child of like two gay men who are obsessed with how talented she is. So she has been taught to navigate the world in a way that is like, check me out, aren't I amazing? And then finds out that that doesn't work with other people. And she doesn't, she's like, this is how I've always been raised. Like, this is how I was told to navigate the world. And it makes
like
people
that kind
hate
of
me.
Love is conditional. Yeah,
exactly. And so she has always, the only way that she can get anyone to see value in her is for what Kurt says in Night of Neglect. She might be difficult, but boy, can she sing. Yeah. And so she's learned to just rest on her laurels and be like, well, I don't know how to get people to like me as a person. So I will just be the most talented person in the room and they'll have to show me some kind of affection because I'm the most talented person in the room. And I always felt like that kind of got lost as the show went on.
Mm-hmm.
And she like wins prom queen and she like gets into NIADA and she wins the freshman showcase and she gets Fanny Bryce.
Yeah.
And I still do kind of feel like it gets lost a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But you talking about Bethany, the way that, A, the reason it kind of gets lost is because she meets Finn and here is a person who, like, yes, thinks she's so incredibly talented, but that's not at all the reason that he's with her. And in fact, is like one of the reasons he keeps breaking up with her because he's like, you're so talented. I think you're not going to like me back. But like she finds someone who sees value in her as a person. And so I think that's kind of why her like that aspect of her disappears. And then for you to point out kind of what London was saying, or was it Irene? It might have been Irene. You pointing out what Irene was saying, that if you take into consideration that the love of her life and like the one person who loved her for more than her talent is now gone, while I am glad they don't explicitly spell that out in the show because it seems a little tactless, it does make sense that she would feel so hollow.
This email rocked my world. One of the most devastating things in here is you pointing out that like Finn ultimately betraying her and bringing her to the train station and how like, you know, her thinking that he is like choosing her, taking her to get married. Like that is like so the most not career thing, not for career thing she could have done. And for Finn to be like, well, you're more important. Your talents are more important. Like just reiterating to her that like this is the thing that she should be pursuing and like nothing else. And like real love isn't worth it. Oh, my God, that hurt my heart. This email was crazy. I really appreciate you sending it in. This is awesome. Hell yeah.
All
that's
right.
Episode.
Ooh. I know you want a relative pitch.
Oh, I do.
We got Wake Me Up by Aviki. Doo-wop, open parentheses, that thing. Close parentheses by Lauryn Hill.
Uh-huh.
Story of Malaf by One Direction. Mm-hmm. Piece of My Heart by Irma Franklin. The Rose by Bette Midler. Do Story of My Life.
Leave my heart open, but it stays right here empty for days. She told me in the morning she don't feel the same about us in her bones. Seems to me that when I die, these words will be written on my stone.
Okay, we're the beginning, the da-da-da-da-da-da. I don't know the words of the song. That was B, several Bs to an F sharp. You're a half step sharp.
Frick.
Sorry. Humiliating.
I would
You'll
like.
Never recover
I
from
know,
this.
Literally. Egg on my face. I would like you to sing. Do you know Piece of My Heart?
Yeah, I do.
Perfect. Will you sing that one?
Take it. Take another little piece of my heart now, baby. Oh, break it. Break another little piece of my heart now, darling. I don't know if that's how it goes at the end, but that's close enough.
I like it.
Okay, so my take it, take another little piece of my heart now, baby, was a D flat to an A flat to like a G flat, then an F, then an E flat, like all that stuff. There you go. That, so what I said was an A flat. He is singing it as an E flat, which means that I am a fourth off.
Whoa.
So good for me. I'm doing such a great job. But is that the original key? Maybe I was singing it in Irma's key. I don't know.
Maybe. Let's look at.
We'll never know. Pull her up. One of my favorite bits on.
Do you want to listen to the Janis one? Because that's the one you know.
I feel like when I listened to the Irma one, I realized that that's the one I knew. And I just always thought it was Janis Joplin. Because I listened to the Janis Joplin one and I'm like, oh, this has more grit to it than I remember.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm still off, but it's closer. I'm only a step flat on this one.
Now let's listen to Janis.
Great. Come on, Janis. Come on, Janis. That's a half step above Irma, so that's even worse. That's a step and a half above me. One of my favorite bits on 30 Rock, just really fast, I always think of it when I hear this song, is Jenna gets a job as Janis Joplin in a biopic, but then they can't secure the life rights to Janis Joplin, but they've already written the movie, so they have to change all of the words so that they don't get sued. So it's about a singer named Jackie Jormchop. And she sings, there's an episode where she's like on some talk show and she sings a song from the upcoming movie, and it's very clearly Break Another Little Piece of My Heart, but all of the lyrics are changed, and all I remember is, you know you got it when it makes you eat food.
That's good.
Anyways, that's your episode of The Backup Plan. Check us out in 2 days when we talk about Old Dog New Tricks, written by our very own Chris Colfer.
Oh my God, I'm so excited. Everyone, have a great rest of your week. We'll talk to you later. Here is a mini kiss on your mini forehead if you accept it. Only if you want it. You don't have to have it if you don't want it.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Recovering Gleek. You can find us on Instagram and TikTok at recoveringgleek_podcast. If you liked our podcast, be sure to leave a review. And tell your friends, please.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.